To make a donation, visit biblicallycorrectpodcast.org/donate. And if you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, and subscribe. Thank you for your support. What makes Yeshua's priesthood better? Welcome to the Biblically Correct Podcast. Shalom, y'all. This is the Biblically Correct Podcast, teaching biblical correctness in a biblically incorrect world. My name is Kevin Jeffrey. I am a Jewish follower of the Messiah Yeshua, Jesus, and I love teaching the scriptures. The Messiah Yeshua is a Kohen, a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. This is the extraordinary concept briefly introduced by the author of Hebrews in chapter 5 to explain Yeshua's most special and unique high priesthood. As we continue our series today on the book of Hebrews, we'll see the letter writer fully develop this concept in chapter 7, explaining how Yeshua's priesthood is set apart from the earthly Levitical priesthood and establishing the foundation for the perfection of his eternal priestly service. So let's jump right in, and in the last verse of chapter 6 and the first two verses of chapter 7, the author says, "A forerunner entered for us into that within the veil, Yeshua, after the order of Melchizedek, having become Kohen Gadol, high priest, forever. For this Melchizedek, Melech Shalem, Kohen Le'el Elyon, who met Avraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom Avraham also apportioned a tenth of all, first indeed, being interpreted, his name means King of Righteousness, and then also Melech Shalem, which means King of Peace." So the last verse of chapter 6 is our thesis statement for all of chapter 7. Echoing Psalm 110, verse 4, which we'll see again later, the author states that Yeshua is Kohen Gadol, high priest, forever, after the order of Melchizedek. Then in chapter 7, verse 1, the author tells us exactly who this Melchizedek is. First, he is Melech Shalem, which the next verse tells us means King of Peace. And he is Kohen Le'el Elyon, priest to God Most High. Then he explains, this is the same Melchizedek who met Avraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. Verse 2, and to whom Abraham also apportioned a tenth of everything he had. And this is essentially the exact same thing that it says in Genesis chapter 14, verses 17 through 20. And the king of Sodom went out to meet Avraham after his returning from the slaying of the kings. And Melchizedek, king of Shalem, had brought out bread and wine, and he was Kohen Le'el Elyon, priest to God Most High. And he blessed Avraham and said, "Blessed is Avraham to El Elyon, who is possessing heaven and earth, and blessed is El Elyon, who has delivered our adversaries into your hand." And Avraham gave him a tenth of all he had. So this is who Melchizedek is, a king priest who met with Abraham, blessed him, and then to whom Abraham voluntarily gave a tenth of everything. And other than the one time in Psalm 110, this is all that the Hebrew scriptures tell us about Melchizedek. That's it. The only other thing we know about him, as the author points out, is the meaning of his name, which just happens to mean King of Righteousness. So this Melchizedek, this King of Righteousness, King of Peace, is the king priest to whose priestly order the Master Yeshua belongs. Continuing on in Hebrews, chapter 7, verse 3 then reveals some rather baffling details about Melchizedek, which are not explicitly mentioned in the Tanakh. This is what the author says. "He is without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, and being made like to the Son of God, he remains a Kohen continually." Okay, so I don't want to head too far down this rabbit hole because ultimately, I don't think we can know with absolute certainty what this means. But there are multiple ways people have understood this verse in saying that Melchizedek had no father or mother or genealogy or beginning or end. Basically, these varying views boil down to seeing Melchizedek either as some kind of divine or angelic figure, a supernaturally preserved human, an historical human being with typological significance, or a pre-incarnate appearance of Yeshua, which I feel confident is not what this is. I talked about alleged pre-incarnate appearances of Yeshua in episode 69. There's actually also a fragmentary manuscript among the Dead Sea Scrolls that depict someone named Melchizedek, which possibly could have been known to the author of Hebrews. But of course, we could speculate on this all day long and never really know for sure. My personal opinion is that there are really only two possible ways to read this verse. The first way is to take it at face value, that he literally had no parents or beginning or end. But I find this to be a difficult reading because it seems at odds with how we find Melchizedek in the Torah. There's nothing in the text or in the silence of the text to indicate that he's anything other than a normal human being, which would mean that he did in fact have parents and so forth. On the other hand, if Melchizedek was literally without genealogy and beginning and end, especially considering that God says in Psalm 110 that the order of Melchizedek is one of an eternal priesthood, then this would serve as an appropriate template and unique order of priesthood to which Yeshua would belong. The author even says a little later that Yeshua is in the likeness of Melchizedek. On the other hand, as Tevye would say, a literal understanding could also undermine Yeshua as the unique one-of-a-kind Son of God. It might imply that Melchizedek is somehow even above Yeshua, since the priestly order belongs to Melchizedek, and this could potentially diminish Yeshua's singular role and highest authority as God's Son. So a literal reading definitely has its pros and cons. The second possible way to read the verse, I believe, is that the author is drashing, or pulling out a deeper meaning from the Psalm 110 concept that the Messiah is a Kohen forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. And the author rightly makes the reciprocal connection to Melchizedek here in this verse, where he says that Melchizedek, being made like to the Son of God, he remains a Kohen continually. So if this is simply a drash, then by saying that Melchizedek had no genealogy or beginning or end, then what he's doing is making use of the fact that Melchizedek is a totally mysterious figure in Scripture, who we know essentially nothing about. He spontaneously shows up in Genesis 14:18, and then he's gone by verse 20, only to reappear a single time in Psalm 110. In other words, the Scriptures literally don't record him having a father or mother or any genealogy. We have no idea where he came from or what happened to him after he intersected briefly with Abraham. So in that sense, he has neither beginning of days nor end of life. The drash, then, would be that since Melchizedek was a king of righteousness, a king of peace, and Kohen Le'el Elyon, priest to God Most High, and since we have no record of his birth or death, his priesthood, therefore, never ended. It remains, in a sense, suspended in time, ongoing forever, and it's in these ways that Melchizedek foreshadows the eternal sacrifice of the Son of God. And this is really the whole point that we need to get from this verse, and eventually the rest of the chapter, that the author is setting up the unusual and mysterious nature of Melchizedek's priesthood as a type or pattern, literal or not, for Yeshua's, that Yeshua's priesthood is unlike any other. And this is what the author now proceeds to illustrate. Continuing his teaching about Melchizedek, he then begins to compare that order of an eternal priesthood to the priesthood of the Levites, the one prescribed in the Torah. Continuing in verses 4 through 10, he says, "And see how great this one is, to whom Abraham the patriarch also gave out a tenth of the best of the plunder. And indeed, those out of the sons of Levi who are receiving the kahuna, the priesthood, have a command to take tenths from the people, that is, their brothers, according to the Torah, even though they came forth out from the loins of Abraham. But he who was not traced from their genealogy nevertheless received tenths from Abraham, and he blessed him who was having the promises. And without any dispute, the lesser is blessed by the better. And here in one case, indeed, men who die receive tenths. But in the other case, it is he of whom it is testified that he was living forever. And so, in a manner of speaking, even Levi, who receives tenths, paid tenths through Avraham, for he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met Avraham. So let's take these verses relatively quickly. Verse 4, and see how great this one is, to whom Abraham the patriarch also gave out a tenth of the best of the plunder. So the author's repeating part of Melchizedek's history with Abraham and setting up the following verses about the greatness of Melchizedek's priesthood. Verse 5, and indeed, those out of the sons of Levi who are receiving the kahuna, the priesthood, have a command to take tenths from the people. So here the author's beginning to set up his comparison, and he's referring to the Torah commands such as Numbers 18:21, which says that to the Levites I have given every tithe, or tenth, in Israel for an inheritance. And they receive this in turn for their service to the priesthood. Then the verse continues to say that the tenth comes from the people, that is, their brothers, according to the Torah, even though they came forth out from the loins of Abraham. So the author is establishing that the tenth that the Levi'im receive are from the people of Israel who are physically descended from Abraham. And while at first blush, this seems like an unnecessary detail about the Levites, the author makes his point in verse 6. But he who was not traced from their genealogy, meaning Melchizedek, nevertheless received tenths from Abraham, and he blessed him, blessed Abraham, who was having the promises, the covenant of promises. So the author is saying that while the Levi'im received tenths from the descendants of Abraham, Melchizedek received a tenth from Abraham himself. And he's showing this in order to demonstrate how both orders of priesthood receive a tenth related in some way to Abraham. And he's going to expound on this further in a couple of verses. Then in verse 7, he adds, and without dispute, the lesser, meaning Abraham, is blessed by the better, meaning Melchizedek. In other words, the one who blesses is greater than the one being blessed, further establishing the greatness of the priesthood of Melchizedek. Then the author continues his comparison to the priesthood in verse 8. And here in the one case, indeed, men who die, the Levi'im, receive tenths. And there in the other case, it is he of whom it is testified that he was living forever, Melchizedek. So the author is still showing that similarity between the two priesthoods. But while the Levi'im and Melchizedek both receive tenths, one priesthood is made up of men who die, while the other is of one who, quote, was living forever, which harkens back to the concepts of verse 3. But then, here's where the author makes his most stunning differentiation between the two priesthoods. Verse 9, and so, in a manner of speaking, even Levi, who receives tenths, paid tenths through Abraham. Verse 10, for he, meaning Levi, was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met Abraham. So what's the author saying here? He's saying that even though both priesthoods receive tithes from the people because of their service, the priesthood of Melchizedek is superior to the priesthood of Levi, the priesthood of Torah. Why? Because even Levi, who receives tenths, paid tenths to Melchizedek, in a manner of speaking, because they are descended from Abraham, who himself directly gave the tenth to Melchizedek. So this whole section was to establish that the priesthood of Melchizedek is better and greater than the priesthood of Levi. And this, of course, would be an earth-shattering revelation to the author's Messianic Jewish Torah-keeping audience. So now that he's established this baseline, the author can proceed with making his case for the high priesthood of Yeshua. And he begins in verse 11 with a challenge to the priesthood of Levi. He says, "If indeed then perfection were through the kahuna of Levi, for the people under it received the Torah, what further need had they for another Kohen to arise, one according to the order of Melchizedek, and not to be called according to the order of Aharon? For in the event of the kahuna being changed, of necessity also comes a change of the Torah." So he starts by calling into question the ability of the Levitical priesthood to make us perfect, to make us whole and complete before God. And the author's making an implication here, which he'll state quite clearly a little later, that such perfection is elusive even through the very same priesthood by which Israel received the Torah. So in essence, the author is saying that the priesthood of Levi is inadequate and insufficient, perhaps even defective. Now, is he saying that God made a mistake in establishing or designing the sacrificial system? Not at all. The problem isn't with the sacrificial system or even the Torah that prescribes it, but with the weakness and inadequacy of the ones who administered those sacrifices, the priests. If you recall, the author spoke in chapter 5 concerning the priests being encompassed by the weakness of their flesh and their need to cleanse themselves from sin. And then we just read in verse 8 here in chapter 7 where he refers to their inability to avoid death, also a weakness. So in asserting this insufficiency of the priesthood of Levi, the author is showing us why there was a need for another Kohen to arise, one according to the order of Melchizedek, and not to be called according to the order of Aaron. Remember that Aaron was of the tribe of Levi and the first high priest of Israel from whom all Kohanim descend. So since the Levitical priesthood can't make us perfect, this produces the need for another Kohen to arise, which can make us perfect and cleanse us from our sins forever. One which in turn requires something extraordinary to occur, as encapsulated in a verse that believers have misconstrued for millennia. Verse 12, "For in the event of the kahuna, the priesthood, being changed, of necessity also comes a change of the Torah." Now the author is going to slowly unpack this huge concept over the next couple of chapters. But the way Christians have typically understood this verse, and the author's following explanation, is that with the priesthood of Yeshua comes not simply a change of the Torah, but a nullification of it. And of course, if you read the book of Hebrews through the law's been done away with eyes, that's exactly what you'll see. But if we just look simply at what the verse says, it's very clear what the author means. In the event of the priesthood being changed, there also needs to be a change of the Torah. Just a change, not an abolishment of the Torah, just one change. And that one change is made to the statute of the priesthood. In other words, the Torah prescribes a priesthood through Levi. But because Levi's priesthood can't produce perfection in us, another priesthood is needed. And notice it just says another priesthood. It doesn't say that the first priesthood is being utterly destroyed and abolished, which is confirmed later in chapter 8. So since the priesthood needs to be changed, and another priesthood needs to arise, one which can bring perfection, therefore the Torah needs to be amended in order to make provision for that other priesthood, thereby changing it. Again, this topic continues to unfold for a while, so I'll revisit this misunderstanding about the Torah as it comes up. But for now, all you need to take away from this section is that the Levitical priesthood can't make anyone perfect, which necessitates another priesthood, which in turn necessitates an update to the Torah. Now, after this, the author finally begins to directly address the matter of Yeshua as that much-needed Kohen according to the order of Melchizedek. And in verses 13 and 14, he says, "For he of whom these things are said has had part in another tribe, of whom no one gave attendance at the altar. For it is evident that out of Yehuda our master has arisen, in regard to which tribe Moshe spoke nothing concerning Kohanim." So he begins by acknowledging the obvious problem with Yeshua as priest, namely that Yeshua isn't legally qualified to serve as a priest, since he isn't from the tribe of Levi, as the Torah commands, but is from a different tribe, of whom no one gave attendance at the altar. He's from a tribe that never served in the priesthood. Then the author declares what's clearly evident about the Master Yeshua, that he's from the tribe of Yehuda, Judah, of which the Torah says nothing in regard to Kohanim. On the contrary, only Levi is permitted to perform the priestly services at the Tent of Meeting and on the altar. Then the author proceeds to expound on this and the need for a change of the Torah. Speaking of Yeshua's priesthood, the writer continues in verses 15 through 19. "And it is yet more abundantly most evident, if there arises another Kohen according to the likeness of Melchizedek, who came not according to the Torah of a command regarding flesh, but according to the power of an indestructible life. For it is testified of him, you are a Kohen forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. For a nullification of the former command indeed comes because of its weakness and uselessness. For the Torah made nothing perfect, and the bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God." So in verse 15, the author is essentially saying that Yeshua's priesthood is more abundantly most evident because in order for that much-needed Kohen to arise, according to the order of Melchizedek, then he can't be from Levi. Therefore, Yeshua is qualified to serve as that other Kohen, since his priesthood, like Melchizedek's, isn't based on tribal lineage, but on something else. And the author continues this train of thought in verse 16, stating that Yeshua's priesthood has therefore come not according to the Torah, which gives commands regarding the flesh that a priest must be of the line of Levi and Aaron. But Yeshua, by contrast, has come into his priesthood according to the power of an indestructible life. That's what qualifies him. And this is why, verse 17, that the author reiterates how the scriptures testify in Psalm 110, verse 4, that Yeshua is a Kohen forever according to the order of Melchizedek. It's Yeshua's indestructible life through the power of his resurrection that puts him in the better priestly line of Melchizedek. Then in verse 18, the author again addresses the change of the Torah, which, as usual, is often misunderstood by believers as teaching an abrogation of the Torah. He expounds on his earlier statements with more direct clarity, saying that because of the need to accommodate another priesthood that is not of Levi, a nullification of the former command indeed comes because of its weakness and uselessness. So again, what the author's calling for is not a nullification of the whole Torah, but of the former command. Which command is that? The command that requires a priest of God to be of Aaron and Levi, like it commands in Numbers 18. So the author is saying that a nullification indeed comes to those parts of the Torah, but only those parts. And that change must be implemented not because of the weakness and uselessness of the command per se, but of the weakness and uselessness and inadequacy of Levi, which is who the commands are about. And in verse 19, he tells us why this change is needed. And this would have blown the minds of the author's readers as much as it should blow the minds of many Messianics and Hebrew rootsers today who are overzealous or militant about their Torah keeping. He tells us, for the Torah made nothing perfect. Now, you know my family and I keep the Torah in our daily life, so I'm not spinning this. But the Torah is not some magical source of righteousness that makes us perfect and pleasing in God's eyes. The author of Hebrews says it right here. The Torah made nothing perfect, and that nothing includes you. But as for the immediate context, what the author's saying is that the commands of Torah can't make sufficient what's inherently insufficient about the earthly priesthood. So instead, a change is needed, one which is not according to the command regarding Levi's humanly weak, useless, and destructible life, but one which causes the bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God. And that better hope is, of course, the priesthood of Yeshua. And finally, in verses 20 through 22, the author has officially left his discussion concerning the order of Melchizedek and arrives at his next main premise concerning the nature of Yeshua's priesthood. He says, "And inasmuch as it," meaning the establishment of Yeshua's priesthood, "was not without an oath, for those without an oath did indeed become Kohanim, but this one became a Kohen with an oath, through him who is saying to him, 'Adonai swears and will not regret, you are a Kohen forever,' by so much more has Yeshua also become the guarantee of a better brit, a better covenant." So the author says that Yeshua's priesthood was established with an oath, which he'll explain in the next verse. And he compares this to the Levitical priesthood, which he says was not established with an oath. But this one, Yeshua, became a Kohen with an oath, as it says again in Psalm 110 from the beginning of verse 4, which says, "Adonai swears," that's the oath, "and will not regret," and then continues, "You are a Kohen forever." So God made an unbreakable oath to Yeshua that he would be a Kohen forever, which is in stark contrast to the priests of Levi, to whom God made no such oath, and in fact, die. So again, the author is further demonstrating the greatness and superiority of Yeshua's eternal priesthood. Only Yeshua can lay claim to a priesthood that God has instituted, not just by command of Torah, but by oath. And it's because of this that the author tells us in verse 22 that since Yeshua's priesthood was established by something better than a command, then that much more has Yeshua also become the guarantee of a better covenant. And this is where we'll pick up in the following episode for the next part of the author's incredible teaching on Yeshua's priesthood. The bulk of Hebrews chapter 7 is the author's establishing of Yeshua's eternal priesthood according to the order of Melchizedek, the mysterious figure who received from Abraham a tenth of all he had and who foreshadowed the Master Yeshua as a king of righteousness, a king of peace, and a priest to God Most High. In comparison to the priesthood of Levi and Aaron, as prescribed in the Torah, the author made his case that the priesthood of Melchizedek is far better and greater. Since the weakness of the priesthood of Levi is unable to make us perfect before God, this produced the need for another Kohen to arise, one who can make us perfect, Yeshua. And though Yeshua isn't from the tribe of Levi and therefore disqualified from serving in the Levitical priesthood, he is qualified to serve as a Kohen forever according to the order of Melchizedek because of the power of his indestructible life. Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Biblically Correct Podcast. If you like this episode and want to see us make more, then we need your help. Visit our website at biblicallycorrectpodcast.org to support the work of Perfect Word Ministries and MJMI through your much-needed donations. And of course, don't forget to rate, review, share, follow, or subscribe to the podcast to receive notifications whenever a new episode is posted. If you have any questions about this teaching, or if there are any other topics you'd like to see me cover, shoot me an email at kevin@perfectword.org. That's kevin@perfectword.org. Until next time, remember that every scripture is God-breathed and profitable for teaching, for refuting, for setting aright, and for instruction that is in righteousness, so that the man of God may be fully equipped, having been completed for every good act. Shalom.